Nächster Redner beschäftigt sich genau mit dem Thema und auch bei seiner Firma Global Voices Online und dem Technology for Transparency Network. Er wird euch neue Wege vorstellen und die Zukunft vorstellen, wie es noch einfacher und intensiver wird, sich in politische Prozesse mit Technologie einzumischen. David Sasaki.
Thanks. So this morning, Yevgeny gave a great talk about how governments are using technology to surveil and monitor their citizens. And then Jeff came up after him and he managed to invite everybody in this room to hang out with him naked tomorrow. So if you weren't here for that and if you want to hang out with Jeff naked, that's your chance. And he also managed to give a really good talk about how we can use transparency to benefit ourselves, the values of personal transparency, and how we use it to monitor ourselves and to monitor our friends. I want to give a third kind of angle on transparency, and that is how citizens are using technology to monitor their governments and to hold their government leaders accountable. Specifically, I want to tackle three questions. I want to ask, what does transparency mean? What are we talking about when we say transparency, especially as it relates to holding government institutions accountable? Two, what does the loss of investigative journalism, which everyone agrees is declining, mean for transparency and for our ability to hold our governments accountable? And three, what is the potential of technology, especially network technologies, to bring about more government transparency and accountability in the future? So, Chapter 1, two false assumptions. I'm going to apologize before I get started on this because I promise I came here to this conference saying that I would say nothing about the 20th year after the fall of the Berlin Wall or the Stasi or Americans' favorite movie, The Lives of Others, which I think every American that I know loves. But in fact, the Stasi and the story that's depicted in The Lives of Others perfectly illustrates a tension that has always existed and exists in every society, but is taking new shapes now with the influence of technology. And that's the tension between governments who want to monitor their citizens and citizens demanding more information from their governments. So the very metaphor of transparency suggests that there is a medium through which we view things and through which others view us. And this metaphor makes the assumption that what is on one side of the transparency medium is conceptually separate, is distinct from what is on the other side. To put it simply, citizens and government are separate entities. The second assumption that it makes is that the nature of what we are looking at through this transparency medium, let's say a glass, doesn't change its nature if we look at it. Of course, both of those assumptions are false. The surveillance techniques of the Stasi are now infamous. I don't think that I need to name them, especially here. But what's interesting is that the Stasi had one spy for every 66 citizens in East Germany. And if you add part-time informants to that formula, then it's one spy for every 6.5 citizens. So it's actually very difficult to distinguish who is on what side of the transparency medium, because it's dynamic and it's flowing and changing all the time. The Stasi stored huge amounts of information about the citizens of East Germany. It sifted through their garbage, it collected samples of their sheets and underwear to match odors for later times, and most famously, it tapped their phone lines and listened in on their phone calls. The point was to spread fear as much as it was to collect information. But as common as government surveillance was at the time, and continues to be today, although it takes new shapes, the fall of the Stasi also illustrates another natural impulse that's been at the heart of investigative journalism since it's existed for about the past 200 years. And that is citizens demanding both information and accountability from their government. So on January 15th, 1990, about 40 years after the creation of the Stasi, a large crowd formed outside of the Stasi headquarters and demanded that the information that the Stasi had been collecting about them as citizens over the past 40 years, since 1950, be handed over. And the Stasi started getting nervous and started shredding the documents. You all know the story much better than I do. And the process of releasing that information, of making it accessible, is still ongoing today. And it's probably the most painful part, I would imagine, of German reunification. But it is a fantastic example, an illustration of a process that's changing and that's happening in a lot of different societies around the world. And that is from a society where government only surveilled its citizens to a society where government and citizens surveil each other, what David Brin calls the transparent society, where we're constantly spying on one another. Chapter 2, from the fourth to the fifth estate, question mark. So in front of a U.S. congressional hearing, the producer of my favorite TV show of all time, which is The Wire, his name is Dave Simon, he said this, and I'm paraphrasing, he said, without investigative journalists, it's going to be a great time to be a corrupt politician in this country. And in his statement to Congress, he held little regard for bloggers. He said that we basically just copy and paste what newspapers have to say, and then we maybe throw in, sprinkle our own little coffee shop opinions. And that's about it. And so I wanted to examine his statement to Congress more closely. Is it really true that mainstream journalism prevents corruption from taking place in government? And if so, will that process of holding governments accountable and increasing information about government disappear as those institutions disappear? And they are disappearing. I know they're disappearing here, they're disappearing at a faster rate in the United States. So the best book that I was able to find about this, about the role of media in holding governments accountable and improving governance, was published last year. It's called The Public Sentinel by Pippa Norris. She's the editor of it. And it charts the idea of the press as the fourth estate, as an institution that exists primarily to hold institutions and those in power accountable. So as Thomas Jefferson famously said, and I think this gets at the heart, the idea of the fourth estate, the basis of our governments being the opinion of the people, the very first object should be to keep that right. And were it left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter. So this idea of watchdog journalism, this idea of the press as a democratic institution, was built into the founding of the first modern representative democracy. And there are many examples and countless movies of how investigative journalism ensures justice, transparency, and accountability. I don't think I need to list all of the cases. Aaron Brockovich was one that was actually turned into a movie, but based on a true story. And more than just investigative journalism, watchdog journalism also monitors the day-to-day practices of government officials so that citizens are more informed and can assess their efficacy and their performance. So watchdog journalism can expose the corruption of traffic policemen, the wrongdoings of a priest, or billion-dollar financial scandals. And the best investigative journalism doesn't just expose corrupt individuals, but entire systems that are flawed and in need of reform. So after the fall of the Berlin Wall, when a lot of countries around the world were moving from authoritarian governments to more democratic styles of governance, a new industry was created called media development. And a lot of this came out of the donor field in the United States and elsewhere. So donors like the Ford Foundation, USAID from the United States government, and the World Bank, they started funding projects to create media institutions, and specifically to train reporters and editors in a lot of different countries, especially in the former Soviet Union, in investigative journalism techniques. So it started in the former Soviet Union, it moved to Serbia and the Balkans after the Second Balkans War, and now these projects are very common around Africa and Southeast Asia. But there are a lot of criticisms of media development and of teaching investigative journalism and watchdog journalism as well. Some of the observers argue, for example, that the adversarial nature of watchdog journalism erodes trust in governments and presents government as more inefficient and wasteful as it really is. Others say that a constant barrage of all of these scandals and corruption stories desensitizes people to actual stories of corruption. So if every single day you see a newspaper article about this or that corruption, you just assume that it's regular practice, and when something really comes up, you don't pay much attention to it. There are even suggestions that in countries that are new democracies, that by constantly attacking what democratically elected leaders are doing, it erodes trust in democracy. And also, many people in East Asia have said that Western-style watchdog journalism doesn't lead to the type of social harmony that many East Asian societies value and shouldn't be forced upon them. Despite these criticisms, watchdog journalism still exists. The watchdog journalists are still treated as heroes often and in a noble endeavor, but these watchdog journalists have come up against two major obstacles to their work, and it's changing. The first major obstacle is the state, and the second is the market. The state censors their work and threatens their safety. The market demands that they make their work entertaining enough to sell newspapers, magazines, and website subscriptions. So a lot of media companies privatized to shield themselves from state censorship. They said, we don't want to be pawns of the state anymore, so we're going to become private companies, only to find that there is no longer a sustainable business model to keep them going. So rather than paying for newspapers, we have our phones. So this decline in sustainable business model of the private media industry has led to a lot of concern about the idea of the Fourth Estate and about newspapers as an institution of accountability. But it's also led to a lot of excitement and enthusiasm about the rise of the so-called Fifth Estate, of networked bloggers, of citizen media types, of all of us in our room, in this room, who are using different platforms to try to hold our governments more accountable. And one of those platforms that people are very excited about, especially this week, that's receiving a lot of attention, is called WikiLeaks, which published a video of US soldiers firing on a van that was picking up an injured Reuters journalist. And it's a site where any citizen whistleblower can anonymously upload a leaked document that exposes wrongdoing. So this is a video interview on Russia Today with WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. Hopefully the volume will work on this.
What does the release of this video say about the role of your website and websites like that in the media? Are you essentially now the new Fourth Estate, the watchdogs, so to speak?
Well, reporters that don't have new information, to some degree, have nothing useful to say. And what keeps people honest and what keeps our management over civilization going is we understand how the world actually works. So the first step in the Fourth Estate is to get information out about the real world. And the second step is to comment on it and to think about it. But we need sources that can get restricted information out to the public. The restricted information is very interesting economically. So when information is held back by a bank or the Pentagon, and extra tension is used to suppress it. In this particular case, Reuters applied for this information under the Freedom of Information Act and spent the last 2.5 years trying to get it and were not able to. Usually that suppression is a result of fear. So in this particular case, it seems that the Pentagon or the US military at some level was scared of that information coming out because of the reform effect of it coming out.
If traditional media, traditional American media, got their hands on this footage, would they air it in its entirety the way that you guys did on your website? What do you think?
I don't know, but I don't think so. I think that is quite unlikely. In fact,
why is that?
It seems that a Washington Post reporter at some stage had access to this material. He writes about part of the transcript in one of his book, The Good Soldiers, by David Finkel. But the video didn't come out. It seems he had access to it at some stage. It didn't come out, and he didn't really address the issues with the victims.
So Julian makes a very important distinction there between the raw source information that reporters use to report on a story and then the contextualization around that source information. And in the past, the journalists were the custodians of that raw source information, making sense of it and delivering it to the citizens. But increasingly, all of that source information is being leaked, is being published, sometimes is being released by the government agencies themselves onto the internet, and in much more chaotic fashion, it's up to every internet user to make contextualization around the information in order to hold the government leaders accountable. So Julian talks about how David Finkel from the Washington Post had access to this video, and he made a nice book about the incident, he wrote some stories about it, but it didn't actually lead to much attention, not nearly as much as the video itself published on WikiLeaks has led. Probably not as much contextualization, because in the end, lots and lots of people are now doing more research about this. But it is important to note that in the end, neither WikiLeaks nor David Finkel have been successful in transitioning this information to accountability over those who were in charge of the situation, those who gave the go-ahead to the soldiers to shoot on the van. So we don't know yet if it will lead to more accountability in the future, but it seems like it hasn't gotten there yet. Chapter 3, the role of technology in the transparency movement. So there's also been a lot of attention given to projects like They Work For You in Britain, which monitors the work of UK parliamentarians and assemblies, and Open Congress in the United States, which monitors the work of Congress in a lot of detail. There's tons of information out there. Mika Seyfried, who's speaking tomorrow, might talk a little bit about this. But there's been much less attention and research and analysis of similar websites that are cropping up all over developing countries. So for the past 5 years, I've been working for an organization called Global Voices, which Jeff mentioned earlier today. And we are kind of a journalism review, but for the blogosphere. So we look on a weekly, sometimes on a daily basis, at the blogospheres of different countries. We translate that material, we contextualize it, so we translate it into English. From English, it's then translated into up to 20 different other languages. And during this 5 years of monitoring the global blogosphere, we've come across a lot of projects, a lot of citizen media and blogging projects that specifically aim to improve governance. And we document them and we interview some of their project leaders, but we haven't had the time or resources to systematically look and evaluate these projects for impact. What actually happens? Do they improve governance? Is there any impact offline that we can measure? So fortunately, we were approached by two different funders, Open Society Institute and the Omidyar Network. They're both interested in the role of technology in the transparency and accountability movement. And they gave us some funding to launch the Technology for Transparency Network, which you can find at transparency.globalvoicesonline.org. And the heart of this is we are going to, right now we have 23 projects. By the end of the month, we're going to have 40 case studies of technology projects, mostly internet projects, in developing countries that aim to promote government transparency, political accountability, and civic participation. And we're also going to publish a research paper at the beginning of next month that kind of takes in all of this. We're also building a toolbox of all of the tools that these projects use, so you can see what tools are most used by which projects. And we found four major categories of these types of projects in developing countries so far. The first category is a complaint-type website, which takes in complaints from citizens and sometimes does stuff with those complaints. Websites that track parliament and parliamentarians. Websites that try to make elections more open and transparent and just. And budget or financial accountability websites. And I'll give some examples of all of them. So this is ishki.com. It's based in the Middle East, specifically in Jordan. It was started by four Jordan technologists who were just so tired of going to cafes and reading blogs in Jordan where there's complaints and complaints and complaints about everything that's going wrong, and the same complaints get cropped up over and over again, but they don't go anywhere. There's no archive of all of these complaints. There's no way that you can look and see who else is making similar complaints. So they created this website which acts as sort of a complaint brokerage. It's early on. Right now, all they're doing is just accepting and aggregating and linking to the different complaints. In Malaysia, there's a very similar website called Penang Watch. It also accepts complaints on the website, or you can phone in your complaint, or you can text message in your complaint. But beyond just collecting all of these complaints, these guys, there's a team of about five of them, they're volunteers, and they harass the city officials until the complaints are answered in some way. So they will write emails first, they will make phone calls, they will visit City Hall if they need to, they will continue to write letters, and they won't give up. For those of you who do software design or development and you know about software bug trackers, this is basically a citizen or a civic bug tracker for the municipality in Penang, where they're based. Kirti is a similar initiative. This is based in India, actually in about five different cities in India, and it uses Ushahidi. A lot of the projects that we're looking at use Ushahidi, which is a crowdsourcing platform that incorporates SMS text messages. You can submit information either by SMS text message or online or by Twitter now. And this allows people to make some complaints or raise civic issues in India. And when we interviewed the guy who founded this project, he said, actually, the city websites themselves should be doing this. This should be a city service. But since they're not, someone else needs to fill in the space. And lastly, in this category, there's Cidade Democrática in Brazil. And this takes a different approach. So rather than just collecting complaints, or rather than collecting those complaints and then relaying them to government officials, they ask their users to make complaints or to cite problems, but they also ask their users to come up with proposals for solutions for each of those problems. So it gets conversations going around the problems. And more than just proposals, also strategies for how to enact the proposals that have come out of them. And so far, they've come up with about two or three successful proposals that have turned into actual projects that are now in motion. It's still pretty early on for the project, but if you go to the case study on the website, you can see the actual offline impact that it's had so far. So another category of projects that we've looked at have to do with tracking the work of parliament and parliamentarians. In Kenya, this is Mzalendo. This is the brand new website design that they're putting together. And this was started by two Kenyan bloggers when the Kenyan parliamentarians took down the parliament website because they were unhappy with their CVs being shown to the world. And so these two Kenyan bloggers and then the larger Kenyan blogosphere said, if you're not going to put up a website showing the activities of parliament, we're going to do it for you. And as volunteers, they went to parliament, they started taking notes, they started tracking bills and discussions, and they published all that information to a very simple WordPress blog. And now they're trying to get a little bit more complicated with it in a good way. Actually, Kenya's parliament, perhaps because of the pressure put up on this website, is now publishing a lot more information about their activities. But Mzalendo is not stopping. They're going to try to get some of this information and distribute it in an offline fashion. So they're going to print up a booklet and try to distribute it offline in Nairobi and other cities. Vota Inteligente is based in Chile, and it was really specifically for the election, but it continues today to make profiles for each of the parliamentarians who live in Chile. And if you search on Google for each of these individuals, you'll oftentimes come up to the profile page before their own website, so you'll get a much more objective, much more informed view of what Chileans have to say about their officials. And this is actually a very interesting case study because they had two different projects that they were doing during election time. One by a very small group of people who created an index to rate the campaign websites of the different presidential candidates and say, a presidential candidate should have at least this basic information on their website in order for voters to make an informed decision. And they did four of these rankings. The first ranking that they did, they found on average that most of the candidates had about 20% of the information that they should have, according to this organization. Then they created a big media fuss, they went on CNN in Spanish, they worked with a lot of newspapers, and by the fourth survey that they did, the candidate websites actually went up to 80%. So it's a really nice way to show how you can have an online campaign and directly lead to quick accountability that you can see and measure. However, that was done by a small team of people. They then had another project called Vecinos Inteligentes, which used the Fix My Street platform to try to crowdsource information about illegal campaign banners and illegal campaigning that was done in neighborhoods where it shouldn't have been done and at times when it shouldn't have been done. And they figured, well, maybe we can get hundreds of different Chileans, all these reports will come in and it'll all be automated. We won't have to do anything. We'll have it automatically sent to whoever the district, the election chief is in that area. But they ended up getting something like 3 reports, and mostly by their friends and family members. So one of the conclusions that we've come up with in our research is that crowdsourcing is actually very difficult to do. That usually most of these projects, just like Wikipedia, just like there was this illusion that Wikipedia was a crowdsourced platform, when in fact there are a team of about 20 or 30 very active individuals, and then just spatterings of other contributions that come along. And it's the same way in most of the projects that we've been looking at here. Today, this is the third and the final day of elections in Sudan. It's the first multi-party elections that Sudan has seen, the entire country, for more than 20 years. You can go on to Sudan Vote Monitor, I think it's sudanvotemonitor.org, right now, and see reports that are coming in. And this is the third category of websites that we've been looking at, which are trying to promote more just and transparent elections by showing, you can see the categories, defamation, disturbances, in access to voting, vote tampering, any sort of voting irregularity. And there are a lot of these projects that have come up. Sudan Vote Monitor is one. There's Cuidemos el Voto in Mexico. There's Vote Report India was another big one. But again, we find that these websites tend to have very little participation by some very active members. Guatemala Visible is a website that is not really about elections so much as the appointment of certain officials. So in Guatemala, you elect most of your officials, but for certain positions like Supreme Court justices and whatnot, those are appointed by others. And for a long time, actually for most of the history of Guatemala's democracy, how those people get appointed is because they have connections with whoever the elected officials are, rather than being appointed on their merits. So Guatemala Visible wanted to make all the information more visible about the justices and the other appointed officials who are appointed. So I talked a little bit about how these election sites oftentimes have very little participation by a small group of people. What I really like about Vote Report Philippines, the elections in the Philippines are happening next month, I think May 9th, something like that. And this is the first time that elections in the Philippines are going to be using automated computers for the voting. So this organization of volunteers is going around the country to different islands and showing people how to use these automated computers. So it's doing voter education workshops, but while they do it, they're also teaching those people at those workshops how to submit reports of voter irregularities using their Ushahidi platform. And that's something that I think is really necessary for these election watchdog websites. You have to train people to use it if you expect them to. Finally, the third category of projects that we've been looking at have to do with financial accountability. And in the United States, recently we passed the largest economic stimulus program in our country's history. To track how that money was used, the Obama administration put up recovery.gov, which has tons of information, more than most of us can process, but you can put in your zip code and you can see which recovery projects are in your area, how the money is being spent, who's in charge of it, and whatnot. In addition, there's an investigative journalism project called ProPublica, and they also have Eye on the Stimulus, which is also tracking the money using different investigative techniques, and also a lot of databases. You can see on the right-hand side, they have all sorts of visualizations of how the money is being used. In Kenya, they had their own economic stimulus program that started in about 2003. It's called the Constituency Development Fund, and this was a way for the federal Kenyan government to give money to local government constituencies and to have them be in charge of their own development projects. So it was a great way to build up local infrastructure and capacity in local government. And there was little tracking that was being done of how that money was being spent. So this budget tracking tool shows you how the money is being spent in every single district in Kenya, and it also allows people to leave comments. I'm going to go through these other ones real quick because I'm running out of time. This is in Israel. This is a project that gets their local budget out of PDF form, which you can't really analyze and visualize, and into Excel format. This is Dinero y Política, which is in Argentina. All of these case studies are available on the Technology for Transparency website. And this looks at campaign finance and visualizes it in Argentina. And again, this information is made available, but on PDF documents that aren't even text-enabled. So they have to use optical character recognition to get the data and to visualize it, and they do it very quickly. There are also a couple projects that don't really fit into these categories. One of them, for example, in Brazil, there's Adote um Vereador, which is an alderman or a local council person. And all they do is ask one Brazilian blogger to blog about one local official once a week. That's it. It's very simple, but I think it's a very effective way to show elected officials that they're being watched, at least by somebody. And not just to watch them, but also to help them out if they need help, if they have some new plan and they want to get community input on it. And I want to end with a project in Kibera. It's the largest slum in Kenya. It's just right outside of Nairobi. And I think it reveals the difficulty that so many of these projects have and are going to have, and just the long, difficult path that it is to really create an information program to improve governance in an area. So this project, they handed out some GPS devices to the residents of Kibera, had them map their own neighborhood, and created the first online map, the first freely licensed map that exists of their community. Now they're training them, they're using flip cameras and training them to make news reports, go into local cyber cafes, file reports, which show up on this map. It's everything from history to corruption to garbage cans that haven't been collected yet. And it's actually been pretty easy to do these technical components. But what they've had the most difficulty doing and what they spent the most time on is just working with locally elected officials and also with tribal chiefs to make sure that they support the project also, and that they're receptive to the information that's published on the website as an input into their policy and legislation choices. Because otherwise, all of this information, all of this work that's done, isn't going to have any sort of effect in government unless that government is involved. Finally, lastly, some conclusions that we've come up with. One, open government data is necessary for sustainable projects. These projects need to be automated. We've talked to too many people who are too burned out, are not making any money, don't have any support, because they have to do a lot of the reporting and investigative work. Instead, the open data should come directly from government. It should come in formats where they can create tools that will look at it automatically, and they don't have to burn themselves out. Otherwise, they just don't look like they're sustainable projects, and they'll probably end in a year or two. The best projects increase participation in government rather than producing skepticism and distrust in political processes. I think that's an important point. Otherwise, you have a lot of disgruntled, angry people rather than a lot of people using these tools to try to build a better society. We have information. We need context. Avoid infodivergence. If you have 10 different complaint platforms in one city, then you can't expect that that your local politician is going to be able to know where to look for the information. So it's important to aggregate the information and to present in a way that makes sense, and also in a way that differentiates it. So if you have a light that a light post that is out in your city, and then you have a police department that's not working at all, those aren't two projects of the same priority. It's important to prioritize and to differentiate what's happening. Otherwise, you just get overwhelmed with a lot of information. Bridge opposing echo chambers, there's already a lot of civic participation and already a lot of information that exists out there on the internet, on blogging platforms and whatnot, but it tends to happen in different ideological spheres. So a lot of people on the left will talk to each other, a lot of people on the right will talk to each other, but they don't come together to shape policy on the issues where there's common ground, and they don't dissect and contextualize the differences. We came up with issues of verifying identities, the difference between seeking answers and seeking accountability or sanctions, and shift from issues to processes. A lot of what we see is that a group of people will come up and they'll protest a particular law or a particular new policy, but that's actually a symptom of something that's more indicative of a larger problem of an entire system that needs reform. And so some of the most advanced projects and the ones that we really think are making the biggest difference are looking at the larger system. And I'm gonna skip that. I think that's it. Thank you. We'll, if anyone has any questions about anything, we can take those.
Unfortunately, we don't have any time for questions.
We don't have time
anymore.
For questions.
No, sorry.
I'm sorry, I had to run through.
But
quickly.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
David Sazaki. Aber ich glaube, David wird draußen bestimmt noch euren Fragen Antwort stehen. Sprecht ihn einfach draußen an. Wir machen gleich weiter mit Dr. Peter Kruse. 15 Uhr ist es jetzt schon, oder?